The testimony we gave to the Commerce Committee was pretty applicable in our feelings on the same thing with the copy of the federal FDA requirements as a retail deal.
Is there anybody that hasn't testified yet that you'd like to?
Chairman, my name is Gene Wiles, and I'm lobbyist for Standard Oil Company of California. I'd like to comment on just a couple of provisions of the bill. I think particularly the one that Mr. Choquette was quite disturbed about. That's 458810D on page 4. No refiner or distributor may engage in price discrimination between dealers unless that discrimination is based upon quantity, purchase, or transportation costs. Now, my understanding was that I talked to Dave Walker, and I don't know whether he submitted an amendment or not, but I do have here a case in the circuit court for in Ardell County in Maryland, and this is a, I did give the full text of this opinion to Senator Rohde, and I wanted to get it to bring over here, but Senator Rohde has misplaced it somewhere. However, this excerpt, this memorandum of opinion, very definitely states that the provision of this nature is in violation of federal law, particularly the Robinson-Patman Act. I have one copy of this left, which I'd like to submit. And basically, what this opinion says is that when you try to prevent competition in trade, such as this provision where it says you have to sell to each party at the same price, except for quantity and the transportation cost, that it is in violation of this act. And my understanding was that there was a note on the bill when it came over from the Commerce Committee on that.
Yep. Mr. Wiles, Mr. Walker did prepare an attachment. Maybe I ought to just read it to you here. I didn't get this before. Does everybody have this system? Dave Walker? I didn't understand that this was the one you were talking about because he had the wrong page in the line number.
Well, he was using the old
one. Yeah, right, and I didn't see that. But on line 17 in the committee substitute, after against the subject franchise dealer, he would insert where the effect of the discrimination may be substantially to lessen competition. And then down on that D, at the end of D, he'd add language to that, stating nothing under this section shall prevent a refiner or distributor from offering a lower price or furnishing a service or facility to a dealer when the offer is made in good faith to meet an equally low price of a competitor or the services or facilities furnished by that competitor.
I'm not too sure that that amendment would take in the two-party station. I haven't had an opportunity to look at it.
We can get some copies made for you.
All right.
Anybody would like to look at it.
One other provision of the bill that was addressed by Mr. Nelson was the goodwill. I'd like to try to make an analogy, if I may. I think the goodwill, as we've explained, the process is that we go out, we make our analysis of the area, we try to determine whether or not a filling station will make a go of that at a certain low application. We put in the studies, the money behind the study. We then either make a determination to put a station in there or not. We build a station, and as the testimony has been, can go up to $500,000. We then attempt to get a dealer, and the dealer comes in, he gets $500,000 station. He has to buy the inventory. If it's a new station, for example, there's no inventory, you'll have to get an inventory. Many of those situations, we even finance the inventory. I mean, if we feel he's a good dealer and a good operator, we loan him the money. He pays it back on a cents per barrel basis. He has the tools, which many occasions we finance. So basically, in some instances, we finance the whole thing. Now when he leaves, I don't care if he's been there for 15 or 20 years or how long he's been there. He's going to be there for a long time. He's a good dealer. He's going to be there for a short time if he doesn't make money. He doesn't make a go of the station. But when he leaves, what does he have coming? He's made a good living on our money, on our investment. We pay him back for what he's invested in it. During this period of years, he's made a tremendous living, and the living depends upon whether he works hard. If he works hard, he's going to make more money. What if the station goes broke? There we're sitting with nothing. Probably his debts. I've been representing this company for a number of years, and we've had this happen several times. And in this situation, he's got his investment back. We'll pay him for that, and he's had a good living. Now the analogy I'd like to make is, I think Mr. Choquette referred to this. There was one person that did testify. And what is goodwill? Goodwill is the goodwill of the guy that's there. When he leaves, he takes it with him. The guy that comes in has got to build this up. Now, if you sell goodwill, say a guy comes in, and this is one of the things that disturbs me most, is, and one of the reasons that we want to select our own dealers, is because we feel that it's better for the consumer. But you go out, and these two people are saying that, well, I'll sell. Well, what is he selling? What is he selling? We built the station. We put out all the advertising. We cover the credit. What is he selling? He's selling goodwill, which there isn't any goodwill. When he leaves, it's gone.
But wouldn't you say that he's actualizing your promotion? I mean, if you didn't have the human body there,
but what is he selling to the next man? The next man comes in, he's got to build up the goodwill.
Building up of that.
Well, yeah, but he's got to do it.
You know,
he's
as the joke Mr. Himself. Cotton made, 70, you know, the guy, the 25% of his constituents, they follow
well, I think
him.
That,
he said 75%. I mean, there's a little more than just a joke in that.
No, there
Maybe.
Is.
Maybe.
Well, this is the joking matter to me, Representative. And I don't think that
there's a situation. Well, I was trying to establish an allegory, sort of in biblical ways.
I'll give you one. But the situation is, now what's the difference? I think the thing that disturbs most of the people in this committee is that because we're large. Let's make an analogy. Let's take one of these little guys that's got his own station. He built his own station. He built it on his own property. And he gets to be 60, 65 years old, and he says, well, I don't want to run this station anymore. I want to lease it, but I don't want to sell it outright either because I want a little income. So he leases it out to another operator. And then, lo and behold, he leases it for 5 years. You get a bill like this, and he finds out he doesn't have a station left anymore. He can't control it. Now, what's the difference? Same situation, except we're Standard Oil, and he's John Doe.
Mr. Wild, why don't you give another one-sided picture to us here? You've been talking about all the big investment made by the company, and the guy doesn't put in anything, and he works, and he gets rich on the deal, and he can go retire and go off, and he doesn't really, only they buy his investment back, and so what's he got to do, right? But, you know, it's pretty obvious, I think, to most of us, that if Standard Oil, or Texaco, or Shell, or anybody else, wasn't making more money by this lease arrangement than he were by hiring, simply hiring employees of so many dollars a week to work in that station, that's the route they'd go. I really think I think you carry it a little bit far with the example you've been giving to us, because we're all aware of the fact that some of the companies do operate their own stations, and they simply pay the people so much a week to work, right? And if that was the most profitable way to go, that's where they'd go. Now, the reason oil companies have this lease deal is that they have found that they make more money with this leased operation.
Well, and so it's quite,
well, I don't know what you're phrasing. Well, you're ignoring that whole side of the question. The second point, I think, is that on your question about goodwill, I think you're oversimplifying that a little bit, too. If I'm wrong, you can tell me where. But I think that probably 99 people in 100 don't really give a damn whether they buy Chevron gas, Shell gas, Texaco, Tesoro, any other brand. Good. And what really attracts them to a particular service station, in most cases, it isn't price or location at their area, is of course the people who work there. The guy knows he can go there, he gets good service, you know, and so he gets a habit of going there. And that dealer sells it. You've been going there for 6 to 8 to 10 years, you don't just switch overnight in most cases and go clear across to the other side of town to follow him. That statement a while ago about all the goodwill leaving when the guy leaves is again, I think, pretty well overdrawn. I'm going to give a fair hearing to the other side of the case, but I don't like these stories that are just way out of reason. That's what it sounds like. I've been hearing.
Well, I don't think it's out of reason. I think that I've seen it happen in Anchorage, Alaska, right out the corner of Northern Lights in Minnesota. There was a fellow there that had the station, and he was very well liked, and he had a good reputation, sold out, and he left.
And every customer immediately stopped coming.
No, but you go look at that station now, look at the volume at that station, what happened to it? And I'm saying that this...
It would be very interesting to know how many people who got in the habit of coming there while he was there still go there only because he made them get in the habit. That's what I'd like to know.
Well, I think that, I don't know what the records would show, but just from my observation, it would be very few make it far.
Isn't it more likely what really happens is, I know this is what I do, is I've moved around a lot, lived in Juneau and Ketchikan, but even thinking of just Ketchikan, that I've seen a lot of stations must have gone through a lot of different owners or leases in the time I've been going to certain stations, and what really seems to happen is you pick out the station where you get good service, and usually that's, you eliminate all the other ones because you got bad service and there's only one left over. Because you don't get good service at any of them. And so you finally get this one that you go to, and then you go there, and then they switch management. And then you go to them the first couple times until they screw up. And then you start looking again for somebody to quit screwing your car up. But you continue going there if the new guy's as good as the old guy. And, you know, I think that's what happens. People only change their habits when they're forced to, and when somebody screws up your car, gives you a $90 bill, and they didn't even time your car right, then you say, the heck with that place. And I think that's probably more realistic as to what happens. I don't think people just leave or they all stay.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly, and that's I think that's one of the points that we've been trying to make. As long as you've got a good dealer, you don't have any problems.
But if the next guy that comes along is a good dealer too, I think your business will just stay. Because most people would rather, you know, keep doing what they're doing as long as somebody doesn't give them a hard time to rip them off.
But isn't that because he is a good dealer too, and right. he's making that business because he is a good dealer, and he's getting paid for it because he's a good dealer.
Right.
Just like the past dealer did.
He's not starting to rob too, of course.
Well, no, I agree with this.
Do they call it goodwill in other, when they sell businesses, or, I remember one time friends of mine, we were going to buy a hardware store, and they had all this, you know, you get a bank loan, you had to get all this assessment of it, they had so much in inventory and this, that, and the other thing. And there was, and one of the things they had, what called it a non-competition agreement, which is, isn't that pretty much the same thing as goodwill or whatever you want to call it? It's just some amount thrown in on the top or...
Well, I think what that is to counteract the goodwill of the person that went out. In other words, say there was a very good dealer, and you went in his place, and what you do is you put in an agreement that he won't compete with you within a certain area, within a certain period of time, because if he did, if he went across the street and opened a station, people would go across the street.
Maybe in this case, it was pretty obvious he was leaving the country, and there's only hardware stores in town. Probably really wouldn't have built one, but I just somehow thought it must have been something very similar. It was just some kind of little chunk of crop.
Well, that's recognition. You see, that's a standard business recognition that, in fact, good business practices can be a threat. Right? The personality that we call in this.
But I think here that one of the real fundamental differences is you don't have a franchise. You have a lease. It's like leasing your house. You go leasing your house to someone, and the analogy isn't really great, but you want control over who he's going to sublease it to. You don't want someone else coming in there that you haven't leased it to. And I think it's your property. You should have control over it. It's a fundamental principle of our system. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll leave this here, Jerry. I don't know whether you've got that.
Yeah. Mr. Nelson, did you want to make a couple more comments?
My question was, and I would like to direct it to Tesoro. They operate under Copper's Tesoro with the Tesoro banner. And we've heard in prior testimony about trademark, you know, the sacredness of the trademark, and that the dealer can't violate trademark violations. But yet Mr. Schofield gave us an indication that they go ahead and go out and buy from any major, wherever the price is right, and go ahead and pump it through a Tesoro pump. I don't understand that.
No, at first place, I'm not Tesoro, Topper's.
It's Topper's Tesoro, is that correct?
It's Topper's service station with a Tesoro product is what we're using. But remember, what I was indicating is that we have an agreement we'll use Tesoro products as long as we have a contract with them. But being an independent operator, we can go to anybody as soon as we want to break that contract and go to somebody else. If we can get a better price and a better thing, we will use their trademark. We are not out buying other people's products or putting them through the pump. In no way. And by the way, I'd like to clarify one thing. When I was talking about goodwill moving Mr. Park, that was a statement made by the proponents of this bill in the Commerce Committee hearing. The man who was testifying for the bill in Commerce made the statement, I did not make it, he made the statement that when he left the service station, went across town to show you goodwill was worth something, he says 25% of people follow me. We just grinned.
Well, my point, I guess, Mr. Kennedy, I don't really care who made the statement. I was in the hearing, I don't particularly give a damn who made it. Now, what I'd like to add are the facts here, and I'm simply, my observation of the facts, and it's certainly one, things don't agree with me. I want to find if I'm wrong or if I'm right or not. But I don't really care what the source of the statement was.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Can I have just a couple minutes? I can get you out my quarter after. Just for the record, I'm John Sanders again. I would just like to comment on a couple things that were mentioned relative to dealer organizations and involvements with them as far as what does Standard Oil do or not do as far as recognizing APRO on what it might have been operating arrangements with dealers. I gathered from Mr. Nelson's comment that we, the oil companies, do not discuss with dealer organizations, be it signs or leases or whatever. And apparently we were very aloof or whatever. I want to tell you for the record for sure, we have what we call Chevron dealer panels. At our expense, we take a dealer from each geographic area in the state. We do it at least every 6 months. We do it sometimes quarterly. And that man will bring to us, from all the dealers in his area, any subject other than price, which we cannot by law discuss with group dealers. And we hold these meetings. In fact, we bring our vice president of retail for all of the West Coast. He comes up along with a manager of dealer sales out of San Francisco. They come down, we sit down, we talk about everything from no check signs to other sign controls we have, to the fact that they would like to have more investment in the service stations, to operating hours, releases, and the whole works. We do discuss it. It's two-way communication. They provide us with their questions, we give them answers, it's all printed up afterwards and published. Okay? The other is, I would like to say that there is a Chevron dealer organization in Anchorage, separate from AFRA, which has about 15 of the 20 Anchorage dealers are members of it. We do discuss things with them. We do not discuss our business with dealer and with relationships with dealers with AFRA. They do not represent solely our people. We have an arrangement with our dealers. So we do not, and we don't plan it. I'd like to mention, too, any previous meetings that we've had with associations, you know, essentially, the contents of this bill have not come up as a demand on us that we should change. So I'm really seriously questioning, who is it that's, where are the dealers who are behind this organization that are supporting the bill, that is supposed to benefit?
Where are the dealers?
Yes, I'd like to know how many of the dealers of the state of Alaska are in favor of this. And I haven't heard Mr. Nelson say how many dealers are for it, and which I don't, and I don't think they care, but I just raise this question. I don't see it. Mr. Nelson also suggests that we arbitrarily and unilaterally sent default letters to all dealers pertaining to no check signs. Just for the record, to clear up this bad image we're getting painted, on December 9th, we sent a letter to all Chevron dealers relative to customer service. I think most of us in the room will agree that customer service has gone downhill in Alaska in the last year. Several of you commented on it. It's primarily manpower problems. That's essentially it. Okay. We sent them a letter. In there, we also commented on negative selling techniques or negative attitudes that are transmitted at our service stations that we're concerned about. One of them being the big red sign that says no checks. This one was brought to us because we told them we felt this was out of line with our sign control, and our lease does control signs. This was brought up by our dealers at our quarterly meeting, and we resolved it in a mutually acceptable, as far as the dealer panel was concerned, a way that there could be an acceptable sign to take care of checks. And we've had two or three meetings since that was resolved.
Pardon me, sir. What was the result? I'm kind of curious about that.
Okay, there is, due to the robberies and the whatever, for there were signs that we had at the station that said cash only after 10 o'clock at night and before 6 o'clock, because service stations became known as an easy place to get yourself $150 if you got a gun. Because if you go there at night, there are generally one or two employees on the station, and with a gun, you can wipe the gun out. So we put on there that a sign, we have signs that we gave to the dealer, okay, that explained. That's why that was. We made an overlay for that that said,
I live in a small town. How does having cash keep you from robbing?
Because as soon as they take a cash, they drop, or credit cards only, exact change, no change. They put it in the safe.
And you can't get to the safe. Right in the check.
Okay, we adapted that sign that talked about cash only or credit cards only to read that in a positive way, in other words, that they want credit cards or cash rather than no checks. Now, this may be very small.
How come you don't say credit cards or checks only, no cash?
because we consider that it's not equal and fair treatment to customers, because in fact, if you put a sign out there that says that the dealer takes no checks, it's not the truth. Because if you are known in that station, you walk in there and he does take your check. And that is not, that is not
if
fair.
If he didn't take cash, who would rob him? That's what I want.
Pardon? No, what I'm trying to tell you is that as far as the dealers were concerned, it's not pertinent to this bill how the sign got there. As far as the dealers were concerned, as far as we were concerned, we had resolved this big problem that Mr. Nelson has related to us, that we've sent default letters and we're going to cancel their lease, and which absolutely was not the case. Since you don't have the testimony of the Commerce Committee hearing, there was the president of the Chevron Dealer Association did provide testimony at that hearing that he and seven other dealers, which represent 30% of our Anchorage dealers, were opposed to the bill. He will send you a copy of that tomorrow on a wire. He was not going to be able to get down. So there are dealers who are not in favor of this bill. Bernie Bilesman, and he will send you a copy of it so you can see. I want to, only one thing other on operating hours. We have operating hours in our lease, and there's been a lot of discussion about operating hours that we mandate. I can tell you that within the last 24 months, we have renewed seven dealer leases to where operating hours have been negotiated, changed, and they've been changed to shorten. Because the dealer told us that it was not profitable. He didn't want to stay open Sunday nights. I don't care, honestly, whether the example I use is whether it's from 6 to 10 or whether it's 24 hours or 7 days a week. Those operating hours in our lease agreements are negotiable and they have changed. And six of the seven that we've negotiated, last seven, six of those have had changes in operating hours as a result of the negotiation, and they've been reduced at the dealer's request, it was not a request of the dealer during the negotiation when we started. My only comment, and I don't really want to belabor the issue on the goodwill and the assignability, as far as how you stand philosophically about it. My position on it, I feel, is that what the law should read is that if I have an asset, I should be able to control it. If someone else has an asset and they don't want to control it, God help them, they can do whatever they want with it. If you've got an apartment and you want to lease it without rights to approve a sublease, you should be able to do that. But if I have an asset and I want to lease it and I want to control the further leasing of it, I should have that right. That's a property right that you're changing materially in this. If other oil companies want to take goodwill, that's fine. It's bothered me a bit. But as far as Standard Oil is concerned, we see assignability and goodwill as hand in glove. And it's absolutely, we'll lose control of our assets. So we see no need for that aspect of the bill.
Mr. Brandon, do you see any constitutional problems with that? United States constitutional problems with that? With any portion of the bill? Do you see any U.S. constitutional problems with it?
I have not researched whether there's a constitutional problem relating to my property right.
That hasn't been raised, Bob.
Pardon? Let me see if I understand this goodwill thing. It's when the guy that is leasing from you as a distributor, whoever owns the station, and then he wants to move on, and so next guy that comes along is going to pay him so much money for the goodwill and pick up the lease from you as a company. So he walks away from this with this money that he got from the guy that's going to be the new dealer. So,
now, so far that, you're not correct. He does not pick up the lease. Okay. So that's not assignable.
No, the new guy does, right?
He does not pick up the previous dealer's lease.
He negotiates with you and gets a lease, right? So, in effect, he could rip this other guy off, get the goodwill, and the guy might not end up with the lease. Wow. I assume that he probably would only pay him if he actually did get the leaf. What I can't understand is, how does that hurt you or help you, whether he gets money from this other guy that wants to come in or not?
We went through quite a bit of this one other time, and I didn't want to belabor with it. It's, as we see it, it's the beginning of true chain service stations, and essentially the demise of an independent dealer being able to take the station. And this, here's how we get there, and that is that we think eventually, if it isn't initially, we'll concede eventually, that the station will go to the highest bidder. And I just, again, you can take it out of the service station business and you're going to sell a car. You're going to sell it to the highest bidder. You're leaving it. You don't care whether the car falls down next month unless you've got an agreement that says otherwise. What it's going to amount to is that this will eventually fall in the hands of the man who can pay the highest for it, which will not be necessarily the one who will do what we feel should be done at the service station as far as keeping out operating hours or the whole routine.
You're not forcing him to give the lease that you hired.
That's right. But as far as we see, assignability and goodwill go hand in hand. Because if you can't assign the lease, nobody's going to pay goodwill. And assignability was taken out of this on the previous go-around. But the words goodwill were left in.
So that's what I can't figure out. The way the bill's drafted right now, how could, I don't see how it can affect you. You might be worried about this other guy's getting ripped off and this other guy's time paying some money. I don't see how it affects
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chairman, my concern is that you're going to put assignability back in it, because as far as I'm concerned, goodwill is worth nothing without assignability. It is worthless. You can't make it happen. And if there's a feeling that goodwill should pass, then you have to have assignability. And assignability, I feel, is if you're holding against me rights that I have for my property.
So,
well, then, on the one hand, you're saying that equity, your equity in your $500,000 corporation, you know, that you're in there trying hard because you have a big investment. And this guy, if he had to put in a higher, if we put in this other part even, with this goodwill, this sort of stalking force, that a little guy would who can buy in for $20,000 is going to do a better job for you. That seems to fly in the face of your corporate action.
No. Wait, see, the other part of this turnover situation that I think we'll address that is, if I were to play this game, I think I could capitalize on it. And if you were an incoming dealer, I could just rip you off badly. And that is that I can take the service station from a dealer as an individual. I can drop the price and move materially greater volumes of product. The incoming dealer that I would find, then I would present, here I have a 200,000 gallon a month service station, whereas the run of the mill may be from 60 to 100,000 gallons. The reason that I got it up that high was the fact of a good location. Okay? I cut the price materially, I got the volume way up, and then you come along and you see, I can show you my books. Here's my sales, okay? The large station. You come in and operate at service stations other places, perhaps, can come in and think you're getting a true bonanza. But actually, what you don't know is that perhaps I ran it at a loss. That's not available. You don't have to have that. Even under this agreement, the outgoing dealers don't have to provide the incoming dealer with what my profit picture was, only my volume. So then you come and you pick it up thinking that you're going to make some tremendous bonanza because of the very large volume that's there. And when you try and price it competitively, but yet high enough so you can make a profit, it drops down to the 30, 40, or 50,000 gallon station, and you've just been had. I've got your quote money, and you paid for a great big station that isn't there. And I think that's the kind of situations that we will bring into effect if we go into this.
So really, to get back to the point, your opposition to that goodwill has nothing to do with how it will affect you. It has to do with that you believe that somebody else, some third party, a new dealer that comes in might get served, and that's what you're...
It's enlightened self-interest. And that is that if that dealer isn't making a good buck, Standard Oil's not going to make a good buck. And that's going to fall. And we've stayed clear through here, and I think all the dealers will tell you. If they make money, we make money. If the dealer comes in and gets ripped up and ends up going out, the station's going to go downhill. The public isn't going to get their gasoline. We're not going to sell our gasoline. We've got a dog in our hands. We're going to try and get over to something.
So the example you gave, sir, was that the highly capitalized bad businessman would come in there, move a high volume of gas, and maybe just lose...
He could even break even.
Just build the volume, and then he'd sell out for
$150,000 to an incoming dealer seeing this very high volume at the service station, and he knows from his previous experience, or if he hasn't had too much experience, he can see that gee, with that much volume, I can make a fantastic living. When indeed, when he then prices it, he won't make that living at all.
But the guy would have to have that $150,000, so he'd have to, or if he went to a bank, do you think they'd ask him?
I think he'll have to have the bank. I think he'll have to have the cash. I don't think he can go to the bank and will be able to finance the goodwill.
Well, yeah, but this guy buying in so he can get ripped off. I mean, he's just sort of, he doesn't know really with all the cards. So, but I mean, in order for the banker to loan him the money, do you think he's going to, do you think this unwitting capitalist is going to have to answer some questions that will elicit further information on the guy that was just breaking even? In other words, that you're paying way too much, and if that isn't the case, and if this unwitting capitalist finances it himself, isn't there some sort of indication that by a buy-in of $150,000 cash, unless he was an heir or something, you know, if he made it himself and it capitalized himself up, then might not he get so easily burnt?
The whole thing. This is just a scenario as what we can see would happen on the basis that it could go to the highest bidder. You then can get the trickery involved in it. And the place that we took the analogy was from Mr. Bilesman, who made the comment to us, if this bill goes through, he says, or if the bill had been through when I was to be a Chevron dealer, he said, I would not be a Chevron dealer today, because I could never afford what these will go for. And he said, my son will probably never be able then to come in and take a business that where with hard work, a location with a lease, could he make out his living like I have. And you will read it. He has said that it was in your testimony, in your hearing.
Sort of a bad limited entry.
And extremely bad.
John, I have one more question from the Senator. I noticed several times tonight people have said we're not talking about franchises. And this bill, of course, you know, has a word in it a number of times. And I'm wondering, it isn't simply a lease in the same way that you lease an apartment, because you don't need to there require somebody to rent an apartment to sell your antiques, furniture, what is you got it, you know, sort. And yet, I wonder what the distinction you're making is, and only you love people who've spoken on this kind of franchises. Are you making that distinction because you do not give this dealer any monopoly on that particular brand of gas, or why is it not being called a franchise? In your view, anybody else present who wants to speak to this?
I would just like to comment that we have not challenged the term franchise versus dealership, because I can't differentiate that much.
Several, a few people at least I know have done it.
I think there were several statements made that the business that we consider that we're in is in the leasing. And if there is some fine distinction, the only one that I can draw is that we do not sell the land as lease. Now, we don't.
You don't sell them the right to sell Chevron products.
That's right.
But you don't give them an option either. If you decide to put a station on the next corner and one which you own and which you hired people to run,
yes,
which is not even in a lease arrangement, nothing stops you from doing that either, is there?
No, sir.
So he doesn't give any guaranteed territory.
No, he does not.
He doesn't pay anything for his franchise or the way that he doesn't give any guarantees either.
That's true. But nor would we intentionally take and put in very large sums of money to siphon our own business off to another location for ourselves. So we don't see it as a problem.
That has happened.
That's true. I would just suggest that under these types of terms, this is John talking, not Standard Oil talking, I don't know why we would ever provide a franchise or a dealer lease, whatever you want to call it, like we have in the past, in the future. I don't know what the incentive would be for us. We will lose control of our service stations. There will be very limited incentive for us to continue to build the types of stations we are at the locations that we are with the money that we have, with the administrative cost to handle it. If there's any other way to dispense with the petroleum products. Nor do I think that if whatever we did do, if we continue to build and to lease or franchise, I would suggest that any new man coming is going to pay someplace between $50,000 and $100,000 for the right to be in a service station. And then he may have something to sell if he bought something.
Yeah, well, of course.
I don't believe that we could sell him anything.
Well, you heard my statement.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'd like to comment on that.
You go back to where you hired. You did it some other way. You take away makes the most money you have at all.
I would like to comment on that.
Let me just finish what I'm saying. Which I think is only. I'm not complaining. I think it's obviously what you should do. But I think also that one thing that hasn't been said, and I think it's true, is that Standard Oil or Shell or anybody else has to get distribution. A good part of the name of the game is distribution. There's 47 standard service stations in the town, and only two Shell. We can be pretty sure we can get most of the business. So there's a certain amount of pressure on you to get those locations out there. Right? Because all the gas thing doesn't do any good sitting back in the refinery on a storage tank. The only business you can go back to your cellar. That's what you got to get distribution, you got to get location. Isn't that correct?
It's an integral part of the total.
So you aren't completely free agents either, exactly.
Well, we are to the degree that we could choose to sell to toppers.
Sure, but you are.
And let someone else do it.
You are to the degree, though, that you can afford to sit back and consume the tanks, right? Back
at nothing happens time. Until you pay your bill.
Sit back and you're fine. You just got to get out to the customers, or else you're in trouble.
I'd like to comment that the only reason that we're in dealer operation in Alaska today, in the fashion that we are, is that with the benefit programs and whatever that we had, and with the 40-hour week, because we were unionized, it was less expensive to operate by dealer operation for a full-service station. If we were to go to a self-serve, I would suggest to you that they will be company-operated with our employees, because it will be then more profitable to do it that way. So that's, your statement is correct. We will go the way that it's the most profitable for us to go.
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple questions. What you mentioned that assignability would be necessary in order to allow someone to sell the goodwill. Is that absolutely? I don't really guess I understand that. Perhaps you could expound upon that just later. You can't, you say that
other,
if we tried to allow them to sell some of this goodwill, we'd also have to mandate assignability as another one of their things that they can do.
So some other oil companies testified to you that they are aware that goodwill passed hands, dollars for goodwill passed hands, and the oil company was obviously aware of it, and they allowed the lease to pass from one to the other.
How exactly did that work? You have, you know, you have the dealer and you have yourself, and then you have the prospective new lessee.
Okay. In my humble opinion, it's sheer stupidity on at least one person's part to make that allows it to happen. Other than the fact that if the dealer who's there, who has a lease, he's in good stand with his supplier. If he will not leave, the other man cannot get the station because we will not walk in and terminate the dealer other than for cause. So for the man who wants the station and who's willing to pay the goodwill, or pay whatever you want to get the station, essentially is paying the man to go terminate his lease with the hope that when he walks in the door with the guy who's terminating his lease, that the oil company will sign the new lease.
Well, he can't get some sort of a prearranged agreement there?
Not as far as we're concerned. And I didn't hear anybody else testify to the fact that that arrangement went on ahead of time.
You wouldn't do that, in other words.
You wouldn't commit to me,
like with Bradley on the station, he was going to give his lease up, and I came to you and said, I'd like to have it. And I happen to know Bradley's going to give it up. You wouldn't, in any way, shape, or form, be able to guarantee me that I'd get it as soon as he got rid of it?
He couldn't guarantee you,
well, could you
that I would give it to you. I could, because yeah. if
That's
I have the right,
you.
If I have
that way, I'd be satisfied. I wouldn't give him any money until I heard from you that I was going to get the lease.
Okay. The way our system works, if he wants to terminate his agreement with us, and dealers do bring people to us and say, we think these, many times they work on the service station as employees. And we will look at this man's qualifications, plus we'll look at the qualifications of anyone that we can find, including other stations, dealers at smaller stations that we want to upgrade, because we do a great deal of upgrading from smaller stations to bigger stations.
Yeah, you know, I just think I asked a pretty simple question.
But I'm telling you that's it. If I would agree to give it to you,
well, you can, then you probably do in some cases.
And we do. We do in some cases. The fact is,
well, so what? Why do you say that assignability is necessary? Then? I don't see.
Because otherwise, there is no guarantee that goodwill can pass.
Well, what I guarantee is that I'm going to get the station. So then I'm willing to pay him to leave. That's what it amounts to, what you said. Now, I happen to know. You know, I must be. Another thing you mentioned was about the profit. I mean, the guy doesn't know what kind of a profit situation he's getting into. He can obviously check the records as to how much the guy's been charging for gas.
You can't.
All right, and see what kind of bills he's got to pay. That's pretty easy to see.
If you do
talk about a bank loan, I mean, you go to the bank and ask them for $100,000, they aren't going to say, well, sure, kid, we'll give it to you. They're going to want to see some figures, too. They're going to have to be satisfied that it can be offered at a profit.
Most of the dealer changes and financing arrangements we've seen have not had banks involved. It's a man who comes in with the money, and that it's not necessarily bankable. He either is going to get it from his father, or he came from another business. And we've seen these things happen.
You've seen the goodwill money change hands, though.
No, we have not.
We don't allow it.
Okay.
Well, you don't allow it, but you can't control it.
We can, to the degree that we check. We know that we have a specific example within the last 6 months to where an outgoing dealer brought us an incoming deal. The dealer he wanted to have. Mm-hmm. And we told him that we would look at all possibilities of all candidates and that we would not guarantee that man got the station. As it turned out, the man did get the station because he was the best qualified. In that case, he was the best qualified. But that's what I'm trying to get across to you. He was an extreme fool, as far as I'm concerned, to have paid the other man any goodwill, because we selected him because he was the best man on the station.
But at the same time, unless there was a guarantee involved, I suppose it gets kind of tricky. But I don't really feel that you convinced me that the assignability is necessary in order to allow the goodwill to be sold.
Well, that's good. I feel that it is.
You know, I'm just trying to figure this thing out. I don't know if that's what's happening there, but I can't figure out if I go to Bradley and I want to get his station from him.
You say I want to go on the business because they're making 50
grand. You know, what you don't know won't hurt you, and what you're worried about is me being stupid. And I guess we all worry about other people in the world being stupid, but, you know, maybe, how about this? Isn't what might happen to you is that, it seems like to me that what would really happen if you allowed this kind of practice to go on is that if you're Standard Oil, the people you're going to lose, the people who are going to sell out for these goodwill agreements are going to be your best dealers. Because if I'm looking around and I'd say, well, Gene Wiles here says that some people make $100,000 in this business. That sounds like pretty good. That's more than the government of the state of Alaska makes, twice as much. So sounds like a good business to get into. And I start looking around at gas stations, and I'm going to look at, for the best gas station, and that's the guy I'm going to pay goodwill, because that's the guy that's making $100,000. So I'll pay Bradley $20,000 to get out of the business, and you know, he'll walk away with $20,000. So the result on you is that you know, you're not going to lose your bum dealers, because I'm not going to pay a bum dealer goodwill. Probably I'm going to pay, if I'm going to pay anybody, I'm going to pay a good dealer.
But I don't know how you will run that service station. You may have the money from your inheritance. You may have lots of other good things to your credit. But as far as your ability to run that service station and your willingness to stay there and run it, with this is primarily our investment and a lot of your effort, if we are, we have no assurance that we're going to have a good operation. And that's what I'm paid to do, is to assure that we have a good operation with the best dealers we can find, sell the most gasoline we can economically.
Mr. Chairman, may I interject just from the Senate bill? The topic that we're discussing, this is the way it was stated. Unreasonably disprove the transfer and assignment of a franchise by a dealer to a qualified transferee or assignee. It doesn't take it away from the oil companies, it just means that they can't unreasonably do it. If the guy's not qualified, let him say he's not qualified, but they won't give him a lease.
I wasn't speaking to the senator.
I think you hit it right on the nose, you know. It isn't, you know, we're not really talking about necessarily goodwill. We're talking about seeing a good business opportunity, and hey, Bradley, I'd like to operate that joint, so look, I'll give you $20,000 and I get to take it over, but before I give it to you, I want to make sure I get to take it over, so I want to get an agreement from this guy that I'm going to get it if you'll leave. So that's pretty simple, I think.
Okay, well, if that's all the testimony, we're in the meeting. Anybody that's interested, the show starts at 9 o'clock.
Shell.
Lucky lady.
I like the first one, the dances. I wanted to do those dances the last night.
No, we usually slightly more than half our members, both legislative and others, are Anchorage members, so we go from there.
Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. The first bill up is Senate Bill 489. Do we have anybody here that was going to testify on 489? That's it.
What 489 does is repeal certain sections of the law which require, if you're an employer hiring a non-resident outside the state, you bring that resident and that person in, you have to require a physical examination of that person. If he's found to be a health hazard, you ship him back. If you don't have a medical examination for that person, you're liable for a fine of $500. It's a misdemeanor. I don't know that it's ever been applied in the last 5 years. It's also unconstitutional. At least in my opinion, it's unconstitutional.
Freedom of travel.
Well, it was the The notes indicate it was passed in 1948, and I presume that was just a reenactment of a previous law. And my assumption was that it had to do with cannery workers.
Seattle, I offered you a job.
The way I read this, the ombudsman offered me a job, recruited me for legal services, and I didn't have a medical examination. Somebody could have been bringing criminal action, there could be a criminal action against me.
Who would have had to pay for the physical?
Call if the statute says who has to pay.
Okay, so this is kind of separate from the issue of the
does it say that
as the paper?
Hey, we're legal now.
Nice going here.
Hey, we got four. If you...
I'm not there yet. I haven't crossed the threshold.
No, really.
Oh,
I'm
excited.
Yeah.
You were coming up with legal.
If he's found on the fifth, the employer has to pay his way back. It doesn't say he pays for the exam. Although, since the employer is required to do it, I would assume he does.
Do you have any, the Senate Bill 489,
I'll just start from the rule of woodworking.
The garbage, water, what's it do?
Repeals the requirement that an employer, non-resident employee would have to get a physical examination before you could fit and work in Alaska. It repeals that requirement.
Well, why are we doing it? It's an anti-Alaskan hybrid.
It's a governor's bill.
It's a governor's bill. It's unconstitutional.
It doesn't make it good.
Apparently it's 30 years old.
Well, we use this as a tool to keep the pointy toes out.
Well, maybe you got a point there, Keith.
The reason we have it.
Anybody with pointy toes is not allowed to go to work. Not physically fit.
We want to keep the Texans up.
Bradley,
well, it doesn't keep them out. What it does is, it says that it says if you come in, an employer brings a non-resident in the state, then you have to get a physical examination. And if you're okay, you're free of disease, then you get a certificate. If you're not free of disease, then they require, then they send you back south.
Well, it's not, you know, why all that stuff that people outside have up here.
Oh, 489.
So it doesn't really do anything other than require people to have physicals. It doesn't mean they can't employ them.
You know, after all, you can't even get in the state of California without inspecting your bag or anybody bringing big flies or something. I'll tell them what these birds bring in.
It's
up to you.
You pass it off. It's called the Tutti Frutti bill.
Hey, Keith.
Yeah.
This is somebody who's filed for housing.
What's
the name? It's a lady. She said she believes she can change the political image of the legislators.
You know, if all those things, those greenhorns sleep.
That's what's known as Queen of the Algea Stables.
Why does she think she can clean?
Well, I can tell you, when I see some of the statements that you know, would-be candidates make in the paper about how they're going to, you know, they just don't realize.
What's your opinion, Father?
I don't know.
Well, that's a real opportunity for somebody to make a good statement.
Next bill, Senate Bill 509.
He said, was it, his experience would allow him to clean up a real legislative bungle. And that's the committee chairman don't announce their meeting schedules prior to that. That's the only thing he's done.
Couldn't he have gotten somebody to write that thing for him?
Senate Bill 509.
Not me.
Do you just want Senate Bill 509?
Yes, Lieutenant Governor's office is asking me to.
Okay.
509, what is that?
Okay, go ahead. Who's going to say any questions?
Representatives, my name is Rob Johnson, I'm Assistant Attorney General, and the Lieutenant Governor's office asked me to come out and just briefly comment on 509. SB 509 basically removes the requirement that a notary public be a citizen of the U.S. And the existing statute which requires citizenship was challenged in a Superior Court case in Anchorage last year, and on researching that question, we discovered, for example, that there is at least one U.S. Federal District Court case which directly challenges the constitutionality of that case. And in that District Court case in Maryland, it was found that citizenship requirements for notary publics was unconstitutional. In the Superior Court case in Anchorage, then the Attorney General's office recommended that the case be settled and the person challenging it, who is not a citizen of the U.S., be allowed to become a notary public. And it was our recommendation to the Lieutenant Governor's office that the citizenship requirements were unconstitutional and that basically SB 509 remedies an inherent unconstitutionality existing in statutes.
Chairman, you're saying that that was a federal district court in Maryland?
Yes, it was.
And that was not appealed?
To our knowledge, it wasn't appealed to the Circuit Court. That's right.
You don't know whether it was appealed?
We know that it was not appealed.
Well, you know that it was not appealed.
That's right.
Well, this other case was the U.S. Supreme Court case, the one on the attorneys.
Yes. Well, there are, in the state of Alaska, there's an Alaska Supreme Court case which actually involving the same party on Dale Park, where his application as an attorney was challenged on the grounds that he wasn't a citizen. And the Alaska Supreme Court rule that he should be admitted as a member of the bar, despite the fact that he's not a citizen. And the same policy analysis for requiring citizenship in the case of lawyers would presumably hold in the case of notary publics.
Let's move the bill.
I say do not pass. I think things like, I'll tell you, this may not be particularly germane to this particular issue. My belief that in these cases, these where, say, a lower federal court makes a decision, and it's especially going to get tested, that the state shouldn't immediately jump, which we did in the case, like Boucher did on the residency thing, and remove our residency clause, but rather I think we ought to wait till they take us to court and make us do it. In other words, just to become subservient to lower court rulings without standing your ground and holding, I think is wrong.
I agree with most cases, but I mean, notary public.
Well, you know, but then, you know, these are all building blocks. They're all part of the chain of events.
Rick suggested one thing on line 14 where it says, and is in fact living here, that should say in Alaska. Instead of saying living here. In the state or in Alaska. It says, see the red port says permanent place of abode in Alaska.
I'll move in Alaska.
any objection to the motion change here to in Alaska? No objection, then it's adopted. Brad?
Thank you, Phil.
This is in violation of the rights statute.
Next bill is Senate Bill 515.
And our reason for the request of the bill dealing with the preparation of the petitions, and this does just apply to the referendum petitions. There is no deadline as such as set out in the law in relation to the initiative petitions. However, because there is a deadline that within 9 days after legislative session is adjourned, then any bill passed by the legislature, if it's going to be referred, it must be done within 9 days after that session has adjourned. And as set it's out now, it requires that we prepare the booklets, petition booklets, and partial summaries, and have the petitions ready to go back to the sponsors within 7 days, which is virtually impossible for us. And it is 7 calendar days, so that would press us include a weekend in there. And we have found that it's very difficult to get the impartial summaries done, the booklets themselves put together, typed up, printed, bound, and then back out to the sponsors of the referendums. And we very much like to have it an additional period of time in which to do this.
Have you in fact gone over 7 days?
No, we never have gone over 7 days. It's, you know, we've gone out on the 7th day. We have done 2 of them at both times. And that does include working nights and weekends just to get there.
This is after you already get the certification completed. So the guys, whoever it is, like in the case of the unicameral petition, was that a referendum?
That was an initiative.
Okay. What's your most recent referendum?
The legislative pay.
Okay, so you had the legislative pay referendum, and it was brought to, what's the procedure there? I mean, it seems like there's quite a bit done, and then they hand it over to you, everything's already completed, and then you have 7 days to do it.
Well, basically what it does is, okay, the people who are sponsoring this, and there's usually 3 people who are what we consider the sponsor committee, those people come in with 100 signatures of their sponsors, and then we go over it, check to see if the people are registered voters, of course. Department of Law reviews it to be sure that it is in proper form. Then that is when it's considered basically certified. The governor says, okay, this is fine. Then we prepare the petition process.
Let me just ask you something. Mm-hmm. At that point, like you still have to pick up these summaries and so forth. When the Department of Law is reviewing it, do they in fact recommend to you, the language that would be included with the petitions as far as these summaries and the impartial summary.
At that point in time, then we know. The only thing they come back in usually is that, okay, this would appear to be in line with the statutes and it meets all the criteria. And then we do a certification saying that for the sponsors, saying that it is in order. And then we do an impartial summary.
This is things you do after you get it. Do you have to do it within 7 days?
Yes. Yes. And then our main problem is, of course, when I brought a sample, it's not actually a sample of a referendum, but it's the same thing. We go through, and of course, there is an impartial summary, which we do ask the Department of Law basically to prepare. Then a copy of the bill to be referred is included in the booklet. And then, of course, we have to prepare places for people to sign, and then certifications, which are to be done. then we take and prepare lists and labels, and once these are done and printed, and send them back, of course, to the sponsors. We then take that point in time and pass the petition booklets around and get people to sign them.
Well, Mr. Jones, after 90 days after the legislature hearings, how much time do you have for certification? Checking the signature and that sort of thing.
It's 90 days. It must be out and back in within 90 days after legislature has adjourned.
Well, you had the original 100 sponsors and so forth that come in and do the thing. No, the whole thing.
The whole thing.
Well, so this extra 7 days comes out of that.
It comes out of that 90 days, yes.
What's the usual length of time to do? So, well, it doesn't take the initial petition of 100 names. That can come in any time. How long does it take you to check those and so forth?
Normally, a couple of days. And that includes having it, sending it to the Department of Law for their review because our time is so short.
Well, my question just related to, you know, who had to eat the extra wheat and whether or not, what, you know, that made it indigestible. And I don't believe it does.
Mr. Brown?
The 90 days is constant, right?
Yes, it is.
And then you currently have to get the booklets out to the people in the mail by 7 days.
7 days.
Okay. And you're asking for a doubling of that. But from the guy that's trying to initiate this referendum, I mean, the pressure should be on the agency, shouldn't it, to assure that the referendums get out to them so that they can, of course, garner the signatures and get them back, because, boy, they're on a sort of a sudden death playoff now. Of course, on some issues, you know, you win some, you lose some, but, I mean, so there shouldn't be any partisanship here, but it seems that a doubling of that is, how many weeks are there in 90 days? 12? 13? Well, it's a great percentile increase. I'm not sure it's justified to double.
Can that referendum initial petition be submitted before the legislature adjourns?
I believe it can, yes.
So it isn't necessarily absolute 90-day limit. 9 days, the whole thing has to be in 9 days after the hearing. But we passed the bill and the governor signed it today. If people didn't like it, they could start. It goes in tomorrow or next day.
Yes, they may.
Yes, that Mr. Chairman, of course, I hate to see this done under crash circumstances when you consider that you've got to print, you've got to do the whole thing. It would appear to me that 5 day work week with people working 37 and a half hours a week is a minimal time. Plus that, you would appear also puts you into an overtime position.
Yes, it does.
And I would think it would be in the public interest to allow some more time.
If based on your experience with these last two, if we give you 14, are you going to take 14 days to do it, or?
No. As soon as, you know, we can get the paperwork together and out they go. I don't think we've helped many initiatives or referendums either, for that matter.
When did the last two come in? Like, I was going to ask the same question Charlie did. Can they submit them before the legislature actually adjourns? So, figuring that the day of adjournment is number one. When were these last two, for instance, submitted?
They've got days right now. I don't really recall. However, the legislative pay came in fairly soon, I believe, after the legislature itself adjourned. And they had, I believe, a considerable longer period of time. The marijuana bill came in I believe, incorrect form, and so it had to be sent back out, and it was redone. And so it was an extra 2 or 3 weeks in there. And then, of course, when they came back in, we went through and verified enough signatures until they were down under the amount that we required in order to have it placed on the ballot. So we did not finish.
What, they didn't get enough signatures?
Right.
Well, a lot of the paper signatures were collected at Fair and Palmer. I'm not sure that really takes place, so you have an idea we're still collecting.
Takes place in
Labor Day.
Right, the last day.
September 9th.
Ends up.
Yeah.
What a chance to call the fair.
There you go. That's gonna.
Hey, well, we've got to pass the bond issue for those guys.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I move, we increase the proposal to 10 days, being one ninth of the time and up.
I'll check.
Huh? Look, I mean, you're dealing with a real constant, the bottom line with the consumer. I mean, you got just 90 days. He doesn't get extended 10 days.
But
then, like I said, or double.
You're dealing with responsible people that have said that they're going to, you know, attempt to be in town, but don't lock them in. Let them exercise responsibility. Which is going to be, they're going to do it as quickly as they can.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on whose ox is being gored. Sometimes I would say.
I know you're sensitive about the marijuana issue.
Yeah. Actually, everything being equal, it should be done to the people. We would have been vindicated. The vote would have been taken by the folk, too. I think
Bradley, I don't know if you realize it, but somehow that one ninth has. It kind of reminded me, it has a pretty constitutional background, kind of like the U.S. Constitution, 3/5 of slaves for population or something. It's a great argument, one ninth. Some kind of compelling constitutional
argument. Not counting Indians, not taxes.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to speak on my amendment, oftentimes we say that we're supposed to legislate for policy and not like personalities. And then, of course, it just depends. I mean, we've all said that over the past 2 years, depending on,
Yes, everybody understand the motion. All those in favor of Mr. Bradley's motion, raise the right hand. All those opposed? The motion passes. You're going to get half your overtime.
That's helpful to us.
I knew the dome machine. Yes, sir.
You'd always hit Mr. Stecky and fight it out before.
I'll give you
a few. As Paul, he's waiting to really ask when the new voters registers can be out, since we all this information. You're involved with that. So what's your target date?
We're planning on doing an update at the end of May, so by about the second week in June, there would be a new list available.
At the local office?
Yes.
When is this?
Second week in June. We have March lists right now, I think, for sale, which is really very current. So.
Yeah, that's well.
Good. We can always use your money.
Do you make money?
No. You got to pay this overtime.
That's right. We'll see it now.
Is this $4, isn't it?
It varies. Some of the districts are $4.
Mr.
Parks has to pay $5, and some are $3.
That sounds like discrimination.
I think it's transportation costs for itself.
Next bill, Senate Bill 724, the supervisor. Yeah, the question was we just wanted Rick to look over this and check it out. And Rick found no problems, and we do have this one amendment on the Board of Fisheries and Game that we discussed.
That's right.
Does everybody have a copy of that?
What's the bill?
It's the revisor's bill.
Okay, and what are you amending?
That Fish and Game amendment that made it subject to the confirmation by the majority of the members of the legislature.
Okay, I know.
Does problem with the amendment. I think we moved the amendment last time because it wasn't drafted. Well, I don't want to take 2 weeks.
They have that on that, or they can do that back.
All right. I have a motion on the floor.
And all the stuff in here is supposed to be fine.
Yeah, we went over it in committee, and nobody signed props, and we just wanted Rick to check it out and see if he found anything. Nobody has brought any problems to our attention.
We don't want to groovy in those ones. Sure, I'll move them, though.
That is no noise, anyway.
What is it?
Well, I just might have a little thing I want to ask. This chimney. Yeah.
Like, what's all the whole bill on the campaign disposal thing is still sitting around this place. Before then, you have to do it.
There's an amendment to this.
Where's that? How to do it?
Where's it? Did we have the time for this stuff? We signed that out. Let's wait to bring that up.
So did we have to pass 587 out of it?
We did. We haven't passed 585 because it wasn't drafted. Next, maybe we can do that tonight. Next bill is Senate Bill 597. No, but I did announce all the bills. Now this bill, we have a letter here from Lieutenant Sterling Gallagher.
Did we take care of this on the road map?
No.
We wanted this one to pass.
And Mr. Gallagher asked us to do to amend a couple of things. And there's a letter from him. I told him to do it. Are you here, Mr. Sterling? Why don't you sit up to him?
Certainly will.
Do you have a copy of the letter that he sent us, the two things that he wanted us to look at?
I know what they are, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Maybe you could,
or perhaps I could wait and see what they are. Maybe you can put something in the letter. I'm not
well, there's this one on section 080. Yep. I'll let it read you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll identify myself. My name is Lewis Nelson. I'm the Office Operations Manager in the Audit Division of the Department of Revenue. And in the absence of Mr. Jenkins, the Director of Audit, why I'm here to speak to the committee and perhaps clarify one or two of these points. I believe that this letter from Mr. Gallagher is primarily to clean up. There was a little bit of conflict here in the language. Specific confusion was in this area within 15 days after the holding of the specific activity. There seemed to be a conflict there in conjunction with the January 31 date. And in addition, the recommendation of the change in the fee structure. The Department of Revenue looks upon that with considerable favor, especially in view of the fact ever since 1960,
the positions that are used to carry out the administrative and enforcement aspects of this particular function have not been funded. And in effect, we borrow people from various different activities within the department in order to conduct this particular this function. And also, I should mention to the committee, in case anyone has overlooked it, that with Senate Bill 686 now passed, we now have some new organizations that are going to become potential permittees under the Games of Chance and Skill.
What is 08-05 and 08-0 referring to? What kind of committees are we talking about?
Oh, these are the ones that are applying for permits to operate such things as raffles, lotteries, bingo games.
Well, that reads my question. What you're doing here, if I read this right, it says the way it does say now is 15 days after whatever event it is, a raffle, a bingo game, or something. But now what you really want is an annual report.
Yes.
If somebody has six bingo games in a year's time, you want an annual report. And whereas presently they'd be reporting after each one individually.
That's correct.
So that should save work for you. You've got one report to handle for the state.
Yes.
The other thing I want to change is how soon you have to turn into legislature in the second part of the bill. Instead of 10 days after the meeting, it only says turn in by March 2nd. So it doesn't mean any extra work or less work, it's just a different time to do it.
Yes.
Well, if that's the case, Mr. Chairman, here's what I don't understand the fiscal note, which calls for $51,000, which presumably is additional cost, but the department should be saving money instead of spending more. I don't really understand that.
I must confess, since I wasn't involved in the preparation of the fiscal note, the explanation to me is that at the present time, the cost of administering and enforcing this particular program is not funded.
Yeah, you're absorbing that in the department operation.
That's correct. Number two, the department, in view of that particular circumstance, has really not enforced this particular area to the extent that it should be. As an example, to my personal knowledge, there has never been an audit, a field audit, as an example, of any permittee, of which, as I understand, there are several large ones, presumably in the Anchorage area. We feel that at some point such audits should be conducted. So, in effect, we are attempting to fulfill the total responsibility, or at least what we believe our responsibilities to be. And the second is, as I mentioned before, with the passage of 686, we now have a new group of potential permittees, which would be labor unions, political organizations. Those are the two that I recall right off the top of my head.
Ring classes.
That's it.
I don't think the other point is that point, John, Mr. Chairman, because this is 597, and this one pertains to it only. Another bill, 686, the number was not a matter of to the department at the time, I wouldn't think.
Yes, Jim.
Yeah.
How confidential are these audits? I mean, is there going to be any practical threat that if this is passed, you get $57,000 or $59,000 from in the budget? What are the likelihoods that the administration would conduct audits and make that public for other than indictment purposes?
Well, I think there is something other than indictment purposes. As an example, while we do not have reason to believe, we have never had the opportunity to test the reporting by any of these organizations to determine whether there may be omitted amounts of money possible, or that really, for the most part, that they are really complying with the law. Most of what we receive, in fact, I should say, I think I'm safe to say all of what we receive, is whatever the committee decides to send us in a written form.
When you do an audit, at what point does it become public? I mean, I guess after you, it wouldn't, is it, protected information?
Yes, it would be confidential information, unless at some time, at some point, criminal activities become involved, and of course, it does become public information.
Fine, so there could be no harassment of unions or political parties by conducting audits for the purposes of political embarrassment, unless there were criminal grounds.
That's correct.
Run that by again.
Well, he says that they're not going out and checking anybody that are these raffle holders and the bingo permits or whatever. They don't audit them because they've never had the bucks. And, I mean, we already know how the administration feels on the issue. They're hard, you know, there's a campaign coming up and one of the avowed organizations in the state that says they don't like the administration's the Teamsters. And I just want to know, and I don't have anything against putting, you know, when people break the law, in most cases, you get them on stuff like that. I just didn't want any sort of political shenanigans.
Well, I hope that it's misused. There will be some political shenanigans.
Well, yeah, but it should come through the criminal process system. I wanted to make sure it was confidential.
It's the only way it can come.
Yeah, well.
Are you an auditor?
Yes.
Are you with the state?
Yes.
I just hope you'll crucify these guys that break the law. You know?
So the record, I want to say ditto to that.
Every Republican makes
now, it would appear to me, you're obviously understaffed to look after this. What would it take, and you have my assurance that I'm going to be upstairs in the Finance Committee before the night's over tomorrow looking for the money that you need.
It's going to be 51-9.
Have you got a fiscal
That's why I was.
You know, look, you know, making sure the money's made available because this legislature, in the years I've been in it, has continuously pushed these jobs off like this and said, well, they don't enforce it. But it's usually because we don't give them what they need to do. In fact, I think there should be a special.
Crack brigade of the blue
right.
ribbon,
blue ribbon,
blue ribbon,
so, crack
like
brigade.
SWAT.
I like that.
Sort of like SWAT.
In fact, if we could get a guy like the Hawk.
Let me ask the committee this: the suggestions that Mr. Gallagher asked change in that first part of his letter in section 080. Does anybody have any problem with those changes? There's one thing Rick suggests where it says authorized expenses there, that it should say all expenses, not just authorized expenses.
Mr. Chairman.
Is there a reason why it says authorized?
All expenses.
Yes. Perhaps as you recall, in this particular area of law, the expenses that are authorized are quite specific and precise. And this is just merely a way of reminding the permittees that it's only authorized expenses as opposed to many expenses which are not allowable.
That was exactly my point. Shouldn't you report those unauthorized expenses also?
Is anybody going to report unauthorized expenses?
No. The letter from this.
Well,
because the bill says all expense, all income and expense. His letter says authorized. The
right.
Bill doesn't say that. Which would be dealing with?
Well, I was dealing with the letter because most of the changes look okay to me there in the letter. He has some additional changes.
Well, I would write with the letter then.
Okay.
In reply to you thinking about the bill.
Yeah.
The letter calls for authorized.
And that was the only thing.
Well, it also calls disbursements of net proceeds, which is not in the bill itself.
Those two would supplement to equal the whole, it seems. Disbursements of net proceeds plus authorized expenses.
Is there some reason why you want that language in? Is
that was equal
net proceeds in there?
Yes, because as in the case of authorized expenses, there are also severe restrictions on how net proceeds may be used.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, no, I'm not sure what's happened as a result of 686.
Yes.
But, for example, one of the letters that the commission's office sent to the people out in Fairbanks was you can't disperse this money unless you do it without regard to race, creed, color, sex, national origin, and age, more or less. Good old things out of the, you know, equal rights type stuff, right? Which is all fine and good, except that, you know, to tell the Knights of Columbus that they've got to attribute their money to all the Protestants and Jews and the high.
We don't
tell the NAACP they got to attribute their money and include the blacks and the natives, etc. Seem to be going a little bit far. And so, you know, I'm just wondering, we're talking this business of disbursements and net proceeds and so forth, and you said there's very strict regulations as to how this must what be done with it. I'm just wondering, you know, if that's the kind of strict regulation we're talking about.
Possibly it may have been an unfortunate choice of words that we used in the letter. This is
the letter said it came from the Department of Revenue. And that's what kind of bothered me, because I see, you know, we're not talking about public funds, which there have to be distributed without regard to race, creed, color, sex, or so. We're talking about people's private money. And I don't see any reason why Mr. Specking's organization, that has its lottery, has to distribute money to Democrats, you know, and so forth.
I hope my organization won't have any lotteries and won't use these gambling methods, which I'm opposed to. But should they, I hope that they will report, that the report will show authorized expenses and disbursements and net proceeds. Now, the fact that somebody gets a letter doesn't mean that it has the force of law or regulation.
Well, the letter was quoting